The Naples of England by Andy Christopher Miller. Chapter 14. 50 miles is a long way. Let the word go forth from this time and place. President Kennedy's rhetoric had held my attention and fired my ambition in a way that the crusty and pompous tones of our own country's great and good never would. The torch has been passed to a new generation. If the American Marines had been only half-hearted about accepting their president's challenge to walk 50 miles in a day, then the young people of Britain would show that we were up to it and would step forward. A friendly rivalry between the two countries and a way of honouring their assassinated president was how Gopher had put it in morning assembly, and a chance to prove what we were capable of. It would reflect well on the school, he said, show the character of its pupils. And now there was even the possibility that the event might be featured on television, on South Today. "That's the only reason you're doing it," said Dick, "so you can be on telly." I protested. The immensity of the challenge had impressed me straight away. The outrageous notion of walking 50 miles had been conceived far away from the parochial concerns of our provincial grammar school. "You were just the same," sneered Dick, "when you went in that marathon twist competition up on the Esplanade last year, and they only ended up showing a couple of seconds on the local news." Although Dick was probably right, I didn't want to concede the point publicly and lose face in front of our friends. And it was true that I had secretly hoped the camera would single me out, dancing furiously to Chubby Checker. But I'd been younger then, a whole year younger. Only Terry and Dick were showing any enthusiasm for the walk. The others, Paul, Ernie and Simon, exempted themselves with various lame excuses. "There was that doctor woman, what was it? Dr. Barbara Moore," said Ernie. "Always on the news, walking from Land's End to John O'Groats." "Nutcase," added Paul. "Called herself vegetarian. Didn't eat meat." "No protein," said Dick. "Sheer folly, essential for body strength." We were all sitting in the long lounge of Dick's parents' bungalow out on the beach road, drinking coffee. His father, Mr. Towers, was the manager of one of the banks in the town centre. Towers, Towers, we called Dick's luxurious dwelling. We often ended up there after the pub or at my house, which was a far less spacious alternative. In truth, I sometimes found these friends tedious company. But if there wasn't a dance on anywhere, it was Hobson's choice. Either go out with them to the Brunswick, where we could get served, or stay in and watch the television with my family. Simon could sometimes instigate a bit of political debate by regurgitating views expressed in his father's Daily Telegraph. And Dick had a slightly more adventurous streak in him than the others, even if it was wrapped up in a lot of fussy and conformist procedures that he'd picked up at Sea Scouts. None of them had a girlfriend, or ever had yet, as far as I knew. At least I kept making an effort in that respect. In the school assembly, our headmaster, Geoffrey McPherson, M.A. Oxon, Geo McPherson for short, or, to be even more abbreviated, Gopher, expanded on his grand plan for the 50-mile walk. Preparation was essential, and Mr. Michelson, who was also a captain in the school's Army Cadet Force, was commandeered to give specialist advice. Stout walking boots were essential. Plimsolls, totally inappropriate. Things called blisters were probably the greatest enemy, contesting that position only with something known as low moral fibre. Acting on these recommendations, I bought a bottle of white spirit from the hardware shop, and for a few evenings before the walk, rubbed this into my feet after washing them in a bowl of hot water. On the big day, I joined the crowd on the seafront at 5:45, with the dawn still to creep in across the bay, having walked from home, thus notching up a first extra mile already. I sought out Dick, who was with his parents at the roadside, with their car, while others stood about in groups with vacuum flasks or khaki knapsacks. The air was full of hearty laughter and raised voices, insensitive to the stillness of early morning on the levelled water. Mr. Michelson's bonhomie and encouragement seemed forced and paternalistic, and I was relieved when Gopher stepped up to cut a white ribbon that had been stretched out between two prefects,
the best of luck to you all," he said. "Let's show everybody what the school can do."
For the first few miles, the string of walkers along the main road was concentrated enough for Dick and myself to be able to hear the banter from in front and behind. Over this first hour, the dawn gained a presence, rendering the orange light from the sodium lamps superfluous. I concentrated on keeping my stride regular and purposeful, and was surprised soon to find myself as far from home as I had ever wandered on foot. The line of walkers began to extend in length as it crawled upwards towards the hairpin bend on the road that crested the Ridgeway Hills. After 8 miles, we skirted Dorchester, Hardy's Casterbridge, as the streets were becoming busier with people engaged in regular morning routines. The commonplace separated from us by some transparent but impenetrable screen. Dick and I agreed to walk at our own pace, perhaps to reunite further on in the day, and he then began to draw ahead of me as our route turned eastwards towards the fully risen sun. Just a mile or so outside of town, I crossed an old stone bridge, the water in the small stream almost hidden beneath a tangle of crowfoot and watercress. Here, or certainly hereabouts, Fanny Robin had collapsed exhausted as she dragged herself, heavily pregnant, towards the garrison town in search of Sergeant Troy. The fictional resonated deeply for me. The jingoistic pride driving this walk and my exhibitionist vanity seemed far less worthy and more contrived. Such musings increased as I moved further into territory that was new to me, and I was only shocked from my silent soliloquies by the sudden shriek of a car horn close behind me. It was Ernie and the others in his parents' car.
"Up the workers!" shouted one of them. "Onward, Christian soldiers!" another.
I was cheered by the moment of companionship, but irritated by their clichéd immaturity. Within a very short time, however, I then began to feel deflated by the thought that I too could be cruising along on an upholstered car seat. All morning, in the lead-up to lunchtime, following a bearing that carried me further and further from our starting point and all familiar landmarks, I was sustained by reverie and the thoughts of eventually turning homewards at Lichit Maltravers. Here I would stop for lunch, and here, when I finally did arrive, I found Dick, with three prefects and Mr. Michelson, dispensing bluff good cheer and cups of coffee. We'd been advised during preparation for the walk not to sit down at rest breaks, so I forced myself to remain standing while I ate the cheese and pickle sandwiches that my mother had packed into an old knapsack borrowed from Dick. The two of us then set off, agreeing to stay together to bolster each other's determination, knowing that the miles past the 30 and then the 40 mark and then still more would gorge themselves on our very last drops of strength and resolve. We passed Wareham after another hour or so, as I occupied myself with calculations, proportions of the journey completed and remaining, and the likely times of arrival at various landmarks. Out of time with my forced footfalls, the numbers floated in an unfocused mist, dissolving each time I neared an answer. On a minor road, somewhere close by, T.E. Lawrence had lost control of his motorcycle, had parted man from machine as each grazed and sparked furiously across the asphalt on their separate, final trajectories. Today, the road beneath my boot seemed solid and malevolent, as if pushing up deliberately to compact the bones of my shins and thighs. Up ahead, swaying from side to side and shuffling onwards alone, was a boy called Robert, whom everybody knew as Crinkle because of his wiry, frizzled hair. He was an isolated and not particularly popular member of the sixth form. His father was a local dignitary, the managing director of a large nautical engineering firm that was the region's largest employer. It was commonly believed that some favouritism or special link had been behind Crinkle being allowed to stay on at school to sit his A-levels for an unprecedented third time in an attempt to raise his grades. Out here on the road, though, yoked together in weariness, We were all three equally exhausted and walked onwards in silent determination. At the top of a slight rise in the road, we could see a perfectly positioned bench facing southwest. From here, under the fading afternoon sun, the town was distantly visible, Portland a brooding hulk, huge and sullen in the sea beyond. We debated the wisdom of sitting down and decided that nothing, not fatigue, cramp, nor blistered feet, could now prevent us from completing the remaining miles. As we sat, saying little but savouring each numb second of our 10-minute rest, a grey Wolsey pulled up the incline towards us and indicated its intention of stopping.
"Oh God, it's Gopher," said Dick.
The last time, the only time in fact, that I'd spoken individually with Gopher was 9 months earlier, a humbling request made in his office at the end of the summer holidays. I had promised to apply myself more fully and improve upon my pitiable O-level results if I could be allowed to stay on at school and enter the sixth form. Gopher had listened without expression, his eyes magnified by his spectacle lenses, the dimple in the centre of his chin pulling in my attention like a whirlpool. I was asked to repeat my surname as he hitched the dusty black gown back up across his shoulders and then ran his finger down the left-hand column on a large sheet of paper on the desk in front of him. Stopping about halfway, he placed a foot ruler across the page and followed a number of columns with his index finger. He cleared his throat and said that my performance marked me out as somebody the school would not normally consider to be sixth form material. And then, as I hung my head, he stipulated the degree of application and sheer hard work that would be the condition for granting my request. When asked if I understood, I forced a "yes, sir," trying hard to make this assent sound more than a resentful grunt. Now, Gopher was walking towards us, slapping his rolled-up driving gloves into the palm of his left hand. He was wearing a pullover with a cravat beneath an open shirt, the first time I'd ever seen him without a collar and tie. His gaze settled on Crinkle, whom he approached first.
"How are you, Robert?" asked Gopher, smiling encouragingly. "Only another 7 miles. Keep at it. You're nearly there."
"Yes, sir," replied Crinkle meekly, gazing at his feet as if in shame.
"And Towers," he said, working his way along the line. "Good lad. Keep it up. Back to it."
"Yes, sir," said Dick, still able to summon an enthusiastic and open grin.
"And how about you,
he asked, turning towards me.
"No sitting about. Not the time to give up now."
But it was. Dick and Crinkle pulled themselves back onto their feet, groaning from their aches and placing their weight carefully onto the sensitive soles of their feet. Not one spark, however, fired through my being. The other two made feeble proclamations of worthy intentions, while the late afternoon pressed heavily onto my ears and eyes, and I lost the struggle to remember who I was and where I had mislaid my very last scrap of self-belief.